Hey guys, it's Brandon. Just an announcement if you didn't know. We continue to build out the educational program over at the Intensive Care Academy. That's our other program at ICU101.com, where we have lots of videos, a couple private podcast feeds, and lots of other stuff. Lately, we've been focusing on the cardiac critical care section, which is both medical and surgical flavors of the cardiac ICU. Just put out a lesson on post-op open heart surgery patients, for those who are into that. It was a popular specialty that a lot of people were clamoring for. So check it out if you haven't, ICU101.com. Now on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello everybody, it is Brandon back here with Brian.
Hey everybody.
No guests today. We want to get back to some basics, bread and butter kind of stuff. Both Brian and I do a fair amount of neurocritical care these days. Isn't it interesting that neurocritical care managed to make its own word? We don't say like surge crit, metacrit. Anyway.
I mean, we say like things like pulm crit and surgical crit, but it's two separate words. Neurocritical is all.
It didn't make up its own like word, stem, or like neurointensivist, like as opposed to like a dumb intensivist,
like a muscular intensivist,
brainy intensivist. Anywho, so in that realm, one of the sort of important bread and buttery topics is dealing with a patient with a high ICP. So an ICP crisis, or you could say herniation, but I mean, ideally, we're preventing herniation. But so we thought we would walk through that sort of situation. And, you know, we're all about practice and details here. So I think a lot of people have some idea of, like, in broad strokes, what you might do in a situation like this. But how do you actually go about it? Because when you have a lot of tools, when there are various tools here, and a lot of kind of, like, options and turning points, then it comes down to, like, well, what's first? And like, you know, how do you follow up and stuff like that? So I think it's practical to see how someone goes about this. So Brian, let us say you're sitting in your neuro ICU and you have a patient there who is, is a 47-year-old female. She came a couple days ago. She had had a severe headache in the community, came in severely obtunded. They scanned her head in the ED and found a large intracranial hemorrhage with a great deal of intraventricular hemorrhage. She was intubated for her mental status, and then on CTA, there was a suggestion of a ruptured aneurysm, which got coiled by neurosurgery. They placed an EVD as well, partly because of the IVH and partly because just for ICP monitoring. At the time, there was no obstruction, but... So she's been here for, it's her second day now, and, you know, since intubation and control of the aneurysm, she's been relatively stable, just sort of chilling. But the nurse comes to you and says, hey, you know, our lady, her ICP, which we've been following with the EVD, it's just been clamped, you know, monitoring, is now 26. You know, when it first went in, it was like low teens. She's like, it's been kind of drifting up today, but now for like a good few minutes, we're around 26. What's your like first reaction and move and like approach to this?
So the first thing I want to know is it 26 or is it spiking up to 26? Because I think that makes a difference, right? People will cough, people will become agitated, all sorts of temporary things that will raise their ICP. So I don't really get concerned unless people's ICP is staying high. So is it staying high or is it just spiking up?
How long? I mean, so if it was just for a moment, like they coughed, that's one thing. Is a few minutes long enough for you to care about?
Yeah, probably 5 to 10 minutes of elevation and not coming back down is something that I want to know about.
Okay. So I mean, this is helpful for people to kind of orient their level of alarm. This is not like VFib, where like you have like a few seconds to respond, but it's not like like an hour, like, you know, let it just do what it's
doing. Yeah, certainly not, right? It's just, certainly within, it's sort of like status epilepticus, right? So if somebody has a seizure, I want to know about it, but it's not really an emergency until it's gone on for a little bit. But again, like with status, we don't want to wait 30 minutes like we used to back in the old days. 5 minutes and we're having brain issues. So yeah, so I want to know about it for sure. And I would expect most of my nurses probably would call, even if it was just bumping up and coming back down. Once, probably not. But if it's doing it, they might say, hey, like she's coughing a lot or she's kind of getting agitated and her ICP is bumping up. It comes back down, but it keeps bumping up. Just to kind of give you a heads up, let you know about it, because there's some things that we can do to sort of prevent those spikes from happening and prevent it from becoming worse.
Yeah. So, you know, it says, well, yeah, I mean, a few times the last few hours, you know, we turned her, she coughed and it blipped up, but it's been like 5-10 minutes now and it's just sort of staying there.
Okay. So my next question is, you mentioned this is an intercerebral hemorrhage with interventricular extension, but then you mentioned ruptured aneurysm. So is this thought to be, is this a subarachnoid hemorrhage or is it just some random aneurysm that caused bleeding into the brain parenchyma itself?
Yeah, I should have said subarachnoid hemorrhage as well. Okay. Yeah, it was a subarachnoid aneurysm that was coiled.
And it's secured.
Yeah, since yesterday.
Good. Okay, so because I think that makes another difference, right? Because if you have an unsecured aneurysm, you really don't want people's blood pressure spiking up. And one of the things that we look at when we look at increased ICP is, I don't really care so much about the ICP, right? I care about cerebral perfusion. And if people have a little bit higher ICP, but they have a little bit higher blood pressure too, and their CPP is adequate, that's less of a concern than if it is, you know, sort of normal blood pressure and higher ICP with a low CPP. So in the case of this person, if their aneurysm is secured, we can let their blood pressure ride a little higher. So I would kind of look and say, well, what's their CPP? You know, not that I'm unconcerned with an elevated ICP, but I would be less concerned if the ICP was, like you said, 26, but the CPP is still, you know, 65, 70.
Yeah. So, you know, let's say it's, the CPP is probably around 50-ish, because she's basically been normotensive. I mean, okay, she hasn't really been high or low, and you haven't been doing anything with it.
Okay. Yeah, so one of the things that we worry about, too, with brain injury is you get this loss of cerebral autoregulation where normally your brain adjusts so that your blood flow to the brain stays pretty consistent, despite highs and lows of blood pressure. But you sort of lose that sometimes with brain injury. It sounds like that's what's going on here, because this lady's not regulating her blood pressure up enough to maintain that CPP. So yeah, I'm a little more concerned. So I think the first step would be to start troubleshooting and make sure that this is real. Is there a problem with the ICP, right? Does the waveform look good? Is it seem to be working okay? Does it drain?
So, I mean, what sort of problems would you imagine? Like it's obstructed and not really communicating correctly with the ventricular space?
Sometimes ICP or EVDs, right? You said this is an EVD, right?
Yeah, not a
subarachnoid bolt. So an EVD goes, you know, we place these a lot of times because of the IVH, right? And this varies somewhat from facility to facility, how aggressive you are with EVD placement. Where I am, we tend to place them less frequently than a lot of other places. But certainly one of the good reasons would be intraventricular hemorrhage with obstruction or potential obstruction of the drainage. So the third and fourth ventricles are not open, or we fear that they're going to be closed off, right? So as that blood starts to clot, it blocks drainage and it causes a rise in pressure. And the EVD serves as a sort of pop-off valve that you can let some of the pressure out from the top. So what can happen, though, is if you've got a lot of blood built up in the ventricle, it can get in that catheter and start to clot. And if it clots, now the EVD is not draining. And if it's not draining, it's probably not measuring appropriate. So if you don't have a solid waveform, if it's flat, for example, then you're probably not transducing an accurate pressure. And that's not to say she doesn't have a high ICP, but I kind of want to double check and make sure that that's not the problem first.
So what would your move be then? Let you say that the waveform was really kind of damped and flat looking.
So if it was really, so first of all, at this point, I would probably have already talked to neurosurgery, right? And let them know that I'm dealing with this issue. And then especially if the waveform is not working, I'd say, you know, somebody needs to kind of come and troubleshoot this EVD. In the meantime, we can sort of do assessments. Has her neurostatus changed? You know, what was she doing before? What was her exam like?
She was really pretty obtunded. So it's pretty much since you've had her intubated, she's been like withdrawing from pain, and that's about it. Her pupils have been, you know, mid-sized and equal.
Okay. So when you have somebody who has an exam like this, that makes it harder, right? If you've got somebody who's awake and talking to you, or at least maybe they're intubated, they're at least interactive and following commands, it's a little easier to tell if their exam has changed. But in this case, I would look at her pupils. I would do a good, you know, neuro exam to see, does she still withdraw everywhere she was withdrawing before? Does she look like she's having neurologic changes? In the meantime, the neurosurgeons can come and they'll troubleshoot the EVD. If they feel like it's, you know, not working, they can always, sometimes they can inject a little TPA in there to sort of break up anything. Or they may go, well, I don't know. So this may not be a valid instrument to use for ICP, and we may just have to look for other signs of increased ICP.
Yeah, some of the moves you'll see are flushing the thing out, you know, just like you could flush anything, flushing it, you know, towards the brain, clear stuff out. You can lower the you know, transducer and the collector down below the bed to create more of a gradient and see if you start, you know, draining more and you get more waveform to. And sometimes it's a positioning thing. Sometimes they'll want to scan it and see, you know, maybe it's out. The tip's not in the ventricle. Maybe right. The tip is right in a clot. That sort of thing.
So presuming that we get the EVD fixed and we're happy with the number and happy with the waveform, then you start looking at sort of, well, what could be causing this and what can we do to correct it? So ENLS, the Emergency Neurologic Life Support course from the Neurocritical Care Society, has a really nice tier kind of management of these things. Starting with sort of just real basic, minimally invasive types of measures you can do, sort of things that we say everybody should get in the neuro ICU. And that's things like, are they adequately sedated? Does she have analgesia to support any kind of pain that she might be having? Is the head of the bed at 30 degrees or higher? Is her neck midline? You know, I can't remember, what did you say the etiology of this was? She just had a headache and presented?
Yeah, she was otherwise pretty healthy.
Okay, so one thing to consider in trauma patients, even if it's just something like somebody fell, you know, at work after becoming unconscious, is a lot of times these people will have C-collars on, and C-collars that are too tight can cause this because they can actually obstruct venous drainage from the brain. So making sure things like that are going to minimize stimulation and things like that.
Now, in a patient like this who is pretty obtunded, not doing much, let's say she's not in any sort of sedation or analgesia.
Yeah.
Would you just give her some stuff and just see if that helped?
Yeah, I'd probably just give her like 50 of fentanyl to start and just see if that helps. Because like you said, it's going to be hard to assess if she's really in pain, especially if she's only withdrawing. You know, so 50 of fentanyl should treat any kind of pain that she's got and sort of settle everything down, and hopefully things will come down. Ideally, if I can get her to a point where I feel comfortable sending her to the CT scanner, I'd probably like to get a non-con of her head just to make sure that things haven't changed significantly. Like
such
she has worse bleeding.
Okay. So not so much asking you whether there really is a high ICP, but is there some other problem you might need to address that
right.
is, like,
right.
you know, we knew that she had a ruptured aneurysm, which is now secure, but is there something that has changed?
Right. And she rebled from her aneurysm, for example. The other thing that could be causing this is vasospasm. You can do transcranial Dopplers to look for signs of vasospasm. Again, that's going to be more helpful in a patient like this where she's not able to really cooperate with an exam because the signs of vasospasm are basically signs of a stroke. So, you know, she might have unequal pupils all of a sudden, or she might have, you know, unilateral deficits all of a sudden, but she might not have either of those. And so transcranial Doppler could help kind of assess for that too.
Do you do TCDs?
We usually use the vascular techs to do them. I know how to do them. I'm not very good at them just because I don't do them very often. I think it's one of those things that learning how to do it is pretty easy with the ultrasound. You just take the phased array probe and put it on the temple and try to measure the flow through the MCA and the ICA and you can calculate the ratio from there. But actually doing it is a little trickier. So I know a lot of people will look up and see there's videos online on how to do this or whatever. And people are like, oh, this is easy. I'll learn to do it myself. Theoretically you can, but I wouldn't trust myself to do it. I would probably just get one of the vascular techs to come.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm wondering your workflow. Is that something you can get done in a timely fashion at all hours of the day in your place?
Not all hours of the day. So during the day, yeah, if I called somebody and said, I need you to come stat, I could probably get someone there relatively quickly. At night, no. There's not a tech in the house that can do it at night, I don't think. You know, we typically on our subarachnoids, they get them daily anyway. So that's another thing you could look at and sort of compare, like what has their TCD looked like? Has it been trending upwards? Things like that.
So let's say you troubleshoot the EVD. It seems to be working. You give a little bit of fentanyl, not a lot of change. You make sure there's nothing obvious, like she's flopped over in bed or something. None of that's the case. Maybe you go and get a scan and nothing seems to have changed, but you're still running like high 20s. Now what?
Yeah. So on the scan, you said nothing's changed. I assume you mean like there's no increase in bleeding.
Right.
Can you appreciate any increase in swelling or
maybe there's a little more? I mean, yeah. Maybe there's a little more shift, something like that.
Okay. So one of the first things you can do, it's sort of easy thing to do, is just do some hyperosmolic therapy. So I prefer hypertonic saline. So in this case, I think 250 mLs of 3% saline is a good place to start. Used to be a lot of places, and we used to do this, and we do sometimes now, it tends to be service dependent. A lot of places would drive people's sodium high. And depending on the amount of swelling at the presentation, they would say, you know, we'll say 140 to 150, 140 to 145, 145 to 150, 150, 155, so forth. A lot of data shows that's probably not very helpful, because your brain sort of starts to adjust to that higher sodium, and you don't get a lot of benefit, and then you also tend to lose any rescue benefit that you have from driving it up quickly. But if your sodium's already high, then you can try mannitol. And both of those kind of work well. But like I said, my go-to is 3% first.
So let's say this person, she came in at like 137, neurosurgeon, everyone was like, well, you know, get her like 140 to 145, just sort of normalish. And she has been like 141. So you would start with a bolus of 3% maybe?
Yeah. Also, one thing to think about, too, is if this is somebody with a subarachnoid hemorrhage, you want to make sure that they're euvolemic at all times. And so while we don't tend to run maintenance fluid as much on patients anymore in the ICU, I think this is a one kind of class of patient where maintenance fluid is probably a good idea, at least to a certain degree, just to kind of keep everything going. So look and see, make sure that she's not severely under volume, and if so, you could just get even a bolus of isotonic, just normal saline, might help. But if her sodium is below goal and she's having ICP, I would give her some 3%, just to sort of help kind of work that osmolar gap.
Do you ever like the higher concentrations of hypertonic?
Yeah, certainly. So that's the other thing I was going to say is if this lady doesn't have a central line yet, I would probably put one in. Because anything higher, so at our place we have 1.5%, 3%, and then we jump up to 23.4%. And when you get up to those higher ranges, it really needs to go through a central line. There's lots of good data that shows 3% through a peripheral is perfectly safe. I don't know off the top of my head how high you can go, because like I said, we just sort of stop at 3% and then jump up to the big guns. So 5 or 7% sometimes is common in places, and those may be okay through a peripheral. I don't know off the top of my head. But if I'm thinking about having to give 23%, then I want a central line. So if she doesn't have a central line, I would probably put one in. And right now, I would just put it in the FEM.
Now, so you would potentially use either 3 or 23%, but you would make that decision. Let's say she already had a line based on like how bad it was, or if she had a line, would you just go
23%? Yeah, so if she's already got a line, I would probably base it on how bad it is. So if she doesn't respond at 3%, or if the ICP is significantly higher and she's having serious neuro changes, then I would just give her the 23%.
How fast? 20% usually you push over 10 minutes or something, but how fast would you give 3%?
I would just have them run it in like a regular bolus. So if I'm giving 250, you could just, you know, give it in over, what is that, like 15 minutes, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Pigeons for a second up like this, you know, I think we tend to just put a line in when they come. Which, and honestly, in some cases, that may be unnecessary. You know, most places are more comfortable with 3% peripherally now. I have even heard of, you know, some more data that maybe you can give 20% peripherally. But, it, you know, these are not like people who are here for 12 hours. These are over many days, and you're often right. giving a lot of hyperosmolar stuff. So at some point, you just, and it just like avoids that being a whole thing. Like, not only what are you going to give, but also like, where can you give it? How good is there? And then they have something extravasate and like turns into a whole thing. But.
Yeah, I think particularly if you're dealing with a higher grade subarachnoid, you know, Hunt has 4 and above. I think they definitely should have a line because I think those people are very prone to things like this. They're very prone to vasospasm. They're very prone to ICP issues and herniation. Their mortality is much higher. So I think you should probably just go ahead and do it so you're not in a position like this where, oh my God, it's an emergency and what am I going to do? Where am I going to put this line? My preference, if I'm going to put a line in somebody with issues that are potentially going to have ICP issues, is subclavian. I know a lot of people are less comfortable with subclavian lines these days. A lot of several of the folks I work with prefer just to do IJs. And IJ works fine. The problem with IJ is that you're potentially obstructing drainage from the head. And so potentially you're going to make the ICP worse. Now, I don't know. I haven't seen any data on how much worse that is. So I don't know that the IJ versus the subclavian is the end of the world in that regard. But I do know that if you have a patient who's, when they come in, they're already having ICP issues, having to put somebody on their head to put an IJ line in is potentially catastrophic. So I know the times that we've done it, it's somebody who is really good, who's really fast, you get everything set up, drape the patient sitting up, et cetera, drop their head at the last minute, put the needle in. As soon as you're in, sit them back up. But I think subclavian is just an easier way to go for that and kind of avoid a lot of those problems.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle to imagine that something small like a triple lumen central line in an IJ is going to really have a huge effect on someone's venous drainage in most cases. But, you know, 2 days later and you're having, like, all these ICP issues, you don't want to have, like, this one thought that, you know, maybe that was part of the problem. I would certainly avoid larger catheters in all cases, but it's nice to be able to get away. And subclavians are so nice in general. A nice, like, workflow, I think, is often they come in, they're probably intubated, you're doing basic stuff. Maybe you're going to put an EVD in. It's nice to have that, I think, first. Because then if you're going to position them, you can watch their ICP. And then if you're going to lay them down, you always know what's going on. I like the subclavian, but you could probably do the IJ too. Certainly only lay them down. And I probably just flat. You don't need to stand them on their head in most cases. Like I said, only until your wire's in and then send them up. So that really can be seconds for most people. If you can't do that, sure, a FEM is no problem. But it is just nice to not have to worry about it. Now, what are you doing with the EVD while you work through these things?
So presuming the EVD is working and draining, you can drain some CSF from the EVD. That's another thing you can do to kind of lower their ICP. So I would probably just take off like 5 or so at a time. You certainly don't want to just leave it open to drain out because people can get you can drain people too fast and cause all sorts of issues. But, you know, if it's not draining already, then you might have to drop it down. So that's the other thing is to look at where is the EVD set, you know. If this is pretty early on, it may be set, kind of low, right, to drain anything that goes above that pressure, right? So we set the EVD, we level it. If it's at 0, for example, you know, or 10, the idea is if the pressure goes above that, gradient, it's going to drain out. So like you said, when we were talking about testing the EVD, you can drop it down to the ground to see if it drains. So if you're not draining at this pressure and you want to drain, you may have to drop the EVD depending on where it's set.
Yeah. And if you haven't had experience with these, it's easier to look at one. But these are just, it's like a pop-off. It's like a waterfall phenomenon. So you level it at, you know, at the level of the head, and then you can slide it up or down to various pressure levels. And then if the pressure exceeds that level, it drains. So if you set it at 10 millimeters, you know, of mercury above the head, then once the pressure in that system exceeds that pressure, it gets high enough to drain, and then it comes out. Whereas if you just close and clamp the thing, it doesn't drain, but you can measure the pressure because you've closed the system and created pressure. You can't measure while it's open. That's not always obvious to people.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, yeah. And so in a case like this, if there was really no problem, it could be that she was just sitting there clamped and it was just for monitoring, in which case now you're saying, let's open the thing and turn it into a therapeutic tool as well. But you know what you pointed out, which is also not always obvious, is that while in principle, you know, you set the thing at 10, if the ICP is above 10, it'll drain. If it's below, it won't. That like may or may not be true. I mean, this is not a perfect like frictionless system. So if it's like should be drained, let's say you clamp it, ICP is 25, but then it's open at 10 and it's like not really draining, it may just, like you said, you just may have to go lower and just make more of a gradient. Maybe it's a little bit cloddy or who knows.
Right. There's all sorts of things that you have to sometimes finagle with these things. And, you know, it bears pointing out, too, again, if you're not really familiar with how these work, typically when they put them in, you set it at sort of a low level. But over time, as you're getting towards the idea of, well, maybe the EVD can come out, they'll raise it up every day. And, you know, it may get to 20, for example, and you go, okay, if it's at 20 and they don't have any issues, their ICP has been fine, you know, we'll clamp it into a clamp trial. And if that works, then we'll scan. And if there's no hydrocephalus, we'll take the EVD out. So depending on where she is kind of in her course, her EVD may be kind of high, in which case one of the easiest things is just drop it. You know, so if it's at 20, right, we're basically getting ready to do a clamp trial. That's probably the first thing neurosurgery would say when you call them is, well, you know, drop it down to zero, or drop it to 10 or whatever, you know, to see if that improves things.
Yeah. So, you know, if this was set at whatever, you might lower, if it was just clamped, you might open it. And then you said, you know, allow it to drain some amount, maybe 5 cc's or something, and then close it or raise it. And then check the ICP again, basically.
Yeah.
And then what, you just keep repeating this if it kept being high?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I would sort of depend on neurosurgery to guide what they want to do, because, you know, I don't know, like, how much are they okay with taking off? You know, so I sort of get them involved in that at that point.
Yeah, there are sometimes, it's easy to think, oh, like, you will empty out fluid, reduce the ICP. That's probably true. But there can be like other anatomic considerations depending on the cause of things. Sometimes you don't want to make rapid shifts in the mass effect. Sometimes you can worsen bleeding. And there is a limit to this too. Once you empty out your ventricles, there's no more fluid to drain and you've exhausted like the room for benefit here.
Right. I was going to say, theoretically, the reason we put the EVD in is to deal with hydrocephalus, right? Hydrocephalus, obstructive hydrocephalus as a cause of intracranial hypertension, right? The ventricles are too big and taking up too much space, so we want to reduce the size of the ventricles. But if the cause of the increased ICP is not CSF, right? It's blood, or it's swelling, increased brain parenchyma, there's only so much you can do draining CSF, right? Because like you said, eventually you're going to drain all of it out and then you have empty ventricles and those are no good. And the problem then becomes swelling versus fluid.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it may be that they put it in purely as an ICP monitor. Some places would use other devices for that. Some places just do EVDs for everything. But you can use it therapeutically up to the point where you can't anymore. You can still have pretty full ventricles if they're full of blood. And maybe you just are not draining that with your device. And sometimes that's when they'll talk about putting TPA or something to try to break some of that up. But, you know, it's certainly not as easy as if it were just fluid. And you also, if you have totally flat ventricles, sometimes you end up not being super effective even for monitoring too. It's hard to even get a waveform because you're just like sucked up against the walls of the thing.
Right. And I've seen neurosurgery put in a second EVD in the case of, you know, say the EVD that or the ventricle the EVD is in is totally full of blood, then they feel like, you know, it's, we're not going to drain blood out very easily. It's not going to be helpful. So they'll put one in on the other side to kind of compare, and or to drain from that side. But usually if it's, if we're to that point, you know, we're trying to figure out like, so what's the cause of the ICP? Is it blood? Is it CSF or is it brain parenchyma?
Right. And certainly if you have someone whose issue was like a TBI or something, it was just like edema, then you may have something like this to monitor ICP. You may be able to drain fluid, but it's not the original problem. You're probably not going to fix the issue that way. And just to talk about communication between teams, the time when you would involve your neurosurgery team, it is probably, sounds like very early in something like this, either at an intractably high ICP or if there was a question the thing wasn't working, but maybe even if not.
Yeah, I mean, so if I went back and saw the patient and did some troubleshooting and felt like, okay, this is real, then I'm probably just going to shoot a quick text to my neurosurgeon and say, just to let you know, Ms. So-and-so's ICP is up. Here's what I'm doing, just to kind of keep them in the loop. But certainly if we said, okay, this is real and I don't think the EVD is working, or this is real and I've tried a bolus of 3%, I tried fentanyl and it didn't work, right? Then you definitely want to make sure that they're involved. Because one thing that we're looking at is there may be more surgical procedures that need to be done.
Yeah. Neurosurgery, I would say, is involved to varying extents in some of these neuro cases, depending on your local culture and staffing and stuff. But for this sort of thing, they are probably interested. They have a device in place, first of all, so that's sort of their problem. There is a potential pathway if this just is not going well where they need to do more stuff. Now, if you're at some kind of like, it's like there's no more things to do, then maybe that's a little different. But still, this is like people care about. And I get also for, you know, you're a, in this case, a neurocritical care APP. When would you involve, like, your attending intensivist in something like this?
Probably if, you know, if we sort of started doing some of the basics and it wasn't working, I would shoot them a text too. Neurosurgery first, like I said, the neurosurgery resident and I would probably look at this and see if we could fix it. But if we're getting to the point where we're sort of doing the basics and it's not helping, then I'm letting my attending know and saying, you know, okay, I did a dose of fentanyl. Neurosurgery is troubleshooting the EVD. I gave a bolus of 3%. I'm getting ready to order some hypertonic, some 23%. We keep 3% in our Pyxis. 23% has to come from the pharmacy. So I would probably go ahead and order it, even if I wasn't sure for sure that I was going to give it, if things were not going well.
Now, we talked about CPP, half of which is the ICP, but the other half is the blood pressure. Are you doing anything with the blood pressure?
Yeah, so it depends. I mean, if she's normotensive, probably not. But if she's hypotensive, then I'm probably doing kind of the things that I would do with normal shock, right? Is just giving fluid boluses, and if that's not helping, starting some vasopressors, just to maintain that. You know, we used to say we intentionally make people hypertensive in these cases to drive pressure up. And a lot of the studies have shown that there's probably no benefit in that. So I wouldn't necessarily drive her pressure up. But I would, if she's not able to maintain a normal tension pressure, I would give her some pressors.
So you wouldn't necessarily target a CPP if you're starting to lose it due to the ICP, but if they're running low, you would certainly fix that.
Yeah. And that's sort of tricky because it seems to make sense that you would say like, well, bump their blood pressure up. But you know, then you sort of, I sort of feel like the more we do for patients, the less we allow their bodies to do, we sort of get into trouble because we don't get the same feedback loop, right? So your body wants your blood pressure up to compensate for something. It's because of a feedback loop. If I'm just driving it up, I don't have the feedback that says when it's time to stop driving it or when it's time to, you know, back off. And we see this a lot with people who have ischemic strokes. They get hypertensive and we say, just let them be hypertensive, right? Their systolic can go to 220 and that's fine because that's what their body needs right now. But we don't make them 220. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it's a tricky area. I mean, we will sometimes push people somewhat higher, but it's certainly not a fix, and it definitely potentially could make some things worse in some cases. I mean, the obvious case would be a bleed or something, right? Could you worsen bleeding with higher blood pressures? And even things like edema. I mean, these can all be fed by higher perfusion pressures. So you certainly don't want to run too far to any extremes, but that's the theme of neurocritical care in general. Like there's no end of the spectrum that's like a fix. So usually somewhere in between is. So let's say you've let this thing drain. You have it set at like zero. It's drained some, but whenever you clamp it, you're still like high 20s. And in fact, you trended up some. You're like 28. You've seen it go to 30. You've given a bolus of 3%. You've given some like fentanyl. Hasn't seemed to make a whole lot of effect. What else?
So one thing that we haven't mentioned, I guess, or we haven't talked about is she's intubated. So I assume she's on some sort of baseline sedation. And if she's not, certainly I would optimize that in addition to the fentanyl boluses. I would probably put her propofol up to 50, maybe putting her on fentanyl drip even, just to sort of start really seeing we really need to get control of things like that. If this is a predominantly parenchymal issue, just swelling, then at this point, neurosurgery is probably considering taking her to the operating room, especially she's fairly young. Young people tend to not have as much room to swell anyway. And so we're a little more quick to do decompressive hemicraniectomies. We're going to take part of the bone flap off to let them swell. So they may be already in the works. If it is, then there's things we can do to sort of temporize things to get them to the operating room. If it's not, then we can still do those temporizing things while they kind of make up their mind if that's going to be beneficial or not. So one thing we can do to temporize things is we can hyperventilate people. We used to do this routinely to just really drive people's CO2 down. But we found that like with hypertonic saline and maintaining a high sodium, it was not beneficial over the long run, probably detrimental, in fact. But in the short term, as a rescue therapy, it works pretty well. And so you can just sort of crank up their rate on the ventilator and drive their PCO2 down.
Yeah, you know, how quick the surgeons are to do decompressive craniectomies certainly seems to depend a lot on the patient. Probably not necessarily because a difference in how much yield there is, but a difference in maybe how much risk there is. They're probably more eager in most cases in, like you said, a younger patient who seems like a better substrate and more chance of recovery versus like a 100-year-old or something like that, where they probably wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. It's interesting. You know, you mentioned the ENLS algorithm to, you know, herniation and these kind of tiered approach. And I think many people learn this, and as they should. But I feel like when you really look at the tiers, it doesn't always map to people's sort of intuitive sense for it. Like your intuitive sense is like do normal stuff, like make sure their head is good. And then it's like hyperosmolar therapy and like maybe some sedation. And then it's like craniectomy. And then the actual tiers are like craniectomy is like in the first tier is like, yeah, to consider. And then it's like more of like the same. And then it's like some stuff you don't usually do, like hypothermia. So it's a little counterintuitive.
Yeah. And I think even those of us who are in practice would say, you know, craniectomy is probably not in the tier one of things we would do.
Right? It says now, consider, but like, yeah, I guess you should consider, yeah, consider. And always, but
and so maybe that's the stand-in for call your neurosurgeon, which I think is appropriate involved, early on. But certainly, I mean, if you had somebody who was like a, you know, 22-year-old healthy, you know, MVC who's got a TBI from that, then the odds of them going to the OR emergently for decompression at stage one probably are higher. But for most people, I think, yeah, we're going to do a couple of other things first. And I think a lot of this is dependent, like you said, not only on your team, but where you are. You know, I'm at a big academic level one trauma center. I can get a person to the OR in 10 minutes, any time of day or night if we have to, you know. But if you're in a community hospital, that might not be possible, right? It might take an hour to get the OR up and running. Get your team called in, et cetera. So,
or you might need to send that patient somewhere.
Yeah, or you might need to send them because you don't have an OR that can go. So I think it is important to say, we need to understand all of the non-operative things that we can do and not just say, well, they need to go for a hemicrania, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and that is the benefit of, quote, considering something very early, because knowing the pathway there may influence a lot of what you do. If you can just pull a trigger and make some a rescue intervention happen like that, then you can do a lot of other stuff and even wait longer. But if you need to, like, put a patient on a helicopter to get an hour away before they could even be evaluated by somebody who can do such a thing, then maybe you should start that process much earlier, even if you're not there yet. You know, the patient who, like, maybe, and then they end up never needing it, but if they did, they wouldn't have gotten it in time, you know, where you are, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's really easy for me as a non-neurosurgeon to say, take somebody to the operating room, right? Because my assessment of it is pretty black and white. They have high ICP. You can fix high ICP by cutting hole in their head. So go cut hole. But there's a lot of other things to take into consideration. Maybe they're a horrible surgical candidate. You know, for reasons that aren't maybe readily apparent to me as a non-surgeon. So I think it's real easy to say, just operate.
Yeah. And you know, it's not a nothing thing to do. Like, I mean, like most compartment syndromes, abdomens, extremities, these are like prolonged, somewhat morbid things. Like these people don't have part of their skull in place for months. And right. It's, you know, it's kind of disfiguring. They like wear helmets and stuff. Like imagine a young, you shave their head. I mean, it's not nothing to do, even if you think that it will go well. So of course, you know, they're going to do it if necessary. But if you're ever like, why don't you just do stuff? Now, let's say a patient like this, they did do a cranny. They came back, you know, their skull is whatever in the freezer or in their belly. Does anything change in your management? Like, let's say their ICP is high again tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, first, there's people listening right now who are like, in their belly, what?
They swallowed it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we put ours in the freezer, I think, but they do put them sometimes.
They used to sew it into your abdomen because it's like perfused there. Now I think uncommonly done because sometimes they get infected and stuff. Of course, sometimes they lose them in the freezer. There's no guaranteed way to keep track of your skull flap. But yeah, you will find patients, you like poke their belly and you could feel their skull flap. It's still done.
And we should say it's in the freezer in pathology. It's not like they put it in a Ziploc bag with wrote their name on Sharpie and it's in the ICU break room freezer next to the Haagen-Dazs.
Yeah. I did see a patient who their flap, their like pocket got infected, had to be taken out by GenSurg or somebody. Yeah. And then the patient's like, my flap. And then they made them one out of plastic or something like that. But
yeah, I mean, this is the old plate in the head, right? That you hear about in old jokes and old movies. Is the person's like, I got a plate in my head, right? It's because that's how they used to have to do it, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so she's back. She's decompressed, skull flap's off. And ICPs are still high. Boy, this is tricky, right? Because now we've already kind of done one of our big gun things. So at this point, I think we're looking at kind of moving up into what I think a lot of people would refer to as medically induced coma. You know, but we would talk about using pentobarbital to just sort of really knock somebody out. Burst suppress them. The whole nine yards. So you got an EEG on them at this point. You want the EEG flat. You want them just totally, totally down. And that's just going to probably help with the ICP, but even more so than that, it's going to help by reducing cerebral oxygen demand. So again, remember, like ICP, CPP, it's all shock. It's all balance between oxygen delivery and oxygen demand. So like in shock, if you can't increase oxygen delivery, you decrease oxygen demand. And so we can do the same things here. So burst suppression, make sure they're not seizing. People at this point tend to have problems with seizures, so I would probably make sure they're loaded up on Keppra or your AED of choice. We don't prophylactically put AEDs on these folks unless they're traumatic subarachnoids, then they usually get 7 days of Keppra. But at this point, probably a good idea to just do it prophylactically to reduce the risk of increased cerebral oxygen demand. Now we're also looking at things like, you know, make sure they're not hyperthermic and make sure they're not hyper or hypoglycemic, watch their hemoglobin, make sure they're not severely anemic. Things like that. Try to optimize oxygen delivery, decrease oxygen demand.
Yeah. You know, it's it may seem like if you take somebody's skull half off, then this is not going to be a problem, but you can still spike your ICP. You've made a bigger compartment, a more distensible compartment, but there's still, the skin is still covering it and you can still fill that space. And it's easy to see. You just go poke the flap and it's could be squishy. It's like an abdomen, right? Or it can be, you know, really taut. I mean, I suppose if you didn't cover it at all, then it could just expand into the room. You know, the new compartment is the entire ICU room, but most people want their brains to be in their heads. So, it can still...
like the guys on Mars Attacks with the brains giving out. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a compartment, basically. And these are really true rescue sorts of things. Penobarb is often kind of the ultimate endpoint of sedation because it's just so deeply sedating. And because it's frankly so morbid that we don't want to do it otherwise. People end up out for days and days and days. It does weird stuff to your body. It's not a lot of fun. And usually other things are like just all the other stuff you were doing, just, you know, use up all the rope you have there. So your hyperosmolar kinds of things, whatever you consider the highest you can push that. What do you get sodiums up to, like 160 or like high 150s maybe?
Yeah. I mean, you can just keep driving stuff up and things like we tried before, like with the therapeutic, hyperventilation, right? So normally, I didn't mention this, but normally if I'm doing rescue hyperventilation, I'm trying to drive your end-tidal basically down to 30, right? So your end-tidal is going to be a little bit different than your PCO2, but I really just want you sort of the low end of normal to slightly low. But if we're desperate at this point, 20s, you know, just really hyperventilate somebody. You can paralyze people. Just like you would do with severe ARDS, again, sort of decreases oxygen demand. Paralyzing people takes away any sort of residual muscle movement that they're doing that would increase their pressure. So you can sort of take over all of their bodily functions, basically. Again, this is why I get worried, though, because like I said, when we talked about pushing people's blood pressure, we're now taking control of all their physiologic functions, but we're not getting the same physiologic feedback that their brain would normally get. So you have to really monitor people because you're doing things to them without necessarily getting the full data on what their body needs. You're maybe looking at just one aspect of things like their brain.
Yeah, it's like you're applying very blunt tools to what is normally a very nuanced process. And that's why, you know, you're sort of pushing many things, but pushing everything doesn't, you know, oh, we'll go lower on the CO2. Well, I mean, you could have rebounds, you adjust to it. Oh, we'll go, you know, oh, like we're setting them up 30 degrees. What if we set them up higher? Well, I don't know if that's better. A lot of this stuff really is like kind of in the middle and then you can push it, but you can't necessarily fix everything. People will also talk about doing hypothermia, you cool patients. I don't think I've ever seen this done for ICP. Have you?
Not really, no. I mean, like I said, maybe put a cooling blanket on somebody to just keep them normothermic to slightly
cold.
No
fever, certainly.
But,
yeah,
right, but no, I don't think I've ever seen anybody like we were talking about therapeutic hypothermia, like dropping them to 30, 32 degrees. I've read about it in the literature, but...
Yeah, and I think the literature has been here and there. I don't think it's... like wrong to do, but I think most places are probably not routinely. I have heard of people getting like further decompressed. Like you do bilateral crannies, a bucket handle. I've never seen it done.
We've done that a couple of times. When you're talking about doing like a bifrontal cranny, that's a real grasping at straws kind of thing. We've done it a couple of times. They typically do not do well just because I don't think there's anything about the bilateral hemicrany that people don't do well. I think it's just that by the time you get to that point, you're so far gone that, like you said, it's really a last ditch kind of effort.
And maybe it's worth mentioning also, some of this depends on where your pathology is. You know, you'll see people with bleeds, for instance, that are sub-occipital in the posterior space. And you know, these behave a little differently. It's a smaller compartment, so you'll herniate more readily. If you put monitors or drains in the lateral ventricles, you may not be measuring the pressure down there, depending on how well it's communicating. And draining fluid from up top may not be what you want because you're encouraging your cerebellum to to move upwards, basically. Yeah. Or likewise, I mean, that's why we say don't do LPs in people and drain a lot of fluid who have high ACPs. That encourages downward herniation. Mm-hmm. And then if you're going to do something like a crani, then it's a different spot, right? You're not trying to decompress up top. You're trying to do it posteriorly. So, you know, many of the same principles. But just remember, like, the head is not just one big pocket.
Right. You know, one other thing I was thinking, and I don't think it's going to really apply to this lady, but depending, again, on your pathology, I've read a couple of case reports out of shock trauma in Baltimore of having intra-abdominal hypertension reflect upwards, right? So somebody who has abdominal compartment syndrome, that may be worsening your ICP. So things like, you know, making sure that you're not increasing your thoracic pressure, increasing your abdominal pressure. You know, one case report I read from shock, they took a girl and like put her flat, but then tilted the bed straight up. So she's essentially standing. So she doesn't have abdominal flexion to press on her belly, that then presses on her chest and so forth. Again, I think those are kind of grasping at straws things, unless you really have a polytrauma patient who has severe intra-abdominal hypertension, or I don't know how you'd have severe intrathoracic hypertension.
Well, you know, what you could have is severe respiratory failure, and maybe they're on a lot of PEEP.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, so thinking about the pressure in your chest and abdomen as something that communicates with the head, it can be useful. It, you know, in a normal person, there's probably not a lot there. But yeah, when you have complex cases where there are reasons for elevated pressures, all that, the blood in the head has to drain into the thoracoabdominal space. And if pressures are high in the chest, you could see how that wouldn't happen as readily. And if pressures are high in the abdomen, you know, that communicates to the chest as well. So if you have, you know, abdominal compartment syndrome, or you're in crazy high PEEPs because of ARDS and you're on APRV or something, you know, see if there is something you can fix in those spaces. Of course, those also may be their own problems, but sometimes it's straightforward. Maybe you have taut ascites and you can drain a bunch of it, something like that. But yeah, I mean, as you move down this sort of pathway, obviously you're getting into a sicker patient with probably a worse prognosis. Doesn't mean they can't get better, but you know, you should be communicating with all your different members of your team so no one is surprised, and probably communicate with this person's family. They should understand this patient is getting sicker, so they're not surprised all of a sudden 8 hours later when someone's like, you know, we're going to go take the top of their head off or something like that. Or 20 hours later when you're like, listen, I don't think this person's going to survive. And they're like, say what now? So, you know, involve them in this because you all understand this patient is doing worse and worse, and everyone should probably understand that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's something that never ceases to surprise me. You know, we'll have, especially in the middle of the night, you know, things will go wrong and you'll have a whole team in the room working, and over in the corner is the family member sound asleep. And you go, how, right? Like, you know, but like, they don't know what's going on. And if they're a sound sleeper, maybe they didn't wake up, or maybe they do, they don't appreciate, because I think a lot of us, we try not to, you know, an emergency in real life in the hospital doesn't look like an emergency on TV, right? On TV, Grey's Anatomy, ER, the shows, everybody's screaming and yelling and throwing stuff around, and there's things going crazy and noises and sirens. And for the most part, we try to not do that. So we try to be very calm. And I think that's good, but I think it also may hurt the understanding of the layperson who looks in the room and goes, well, you know, that guy told me if I'm not freaking out, you shouldn't freak out. And he's not freaking out, so I'm okay, I guess. In which case, I should probably turn around and go, hey, I actually kind of am freaking out. I'm just doing a good job of being chill right now. So,
yeah. Or, you know, if you're making calls and stuff, if some people are more communicators and some are less, but it can be tough. You know, I don't think it's generally helpful to loop families into every last thing because they don't understand any of it. And some of it, you know, many things you don't know the impact of, the importance of right away. Like the start of this case, oh, the ICP is a little high. Right. Maybe, you know, we just fixed something. You gave him a little sedation and it got better, never came up again, something like that.
Right. It's a blip.
But yeah, at you know, major milestones, communicate the general message they should care about, which is that things are doing worse. You know, we're doing additional measures. We're maybe considering others, but that's the direction of things. And they're looking, you know, more and more sick. And that we generally, you still don't know what's going to happen. So, and we're not predicting the future here, but you know, the odds are basically getting worse as we go. So that's where we're at.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this before. In fact, we might have done a whole episode on it of like when to call families. And I think this is one of the hardest calls to make is when do you call, especially if it's the middle of the night, like when do you call and wake a family up in the middle of the night to tell them something bad is happening? Because you have to consider that, like you said, it may be something that just resolves and it'll be fine. And when they come in the morning anyway, you can have that conversation and say, hey, overnight, this happened, blah, blah, blah. But it's not worth waking them up for. Or, you know, are they going to panic and like get in the car and come flying to the hospital and get in a car accident? Because you've freaked them out calling them at 2 a.m. and it turns out it wasn't a big deal. But at the same time, I mean, what if it is a big deal, right? What if this turns into a, you know, now your phone call is, I'm sorry, but your family member died, instead of we're having some issues. So I think that's a really tough call to make, when to call the family and when to talk to them. That I think just only comes with experience.
Yeah. And I think some people, not wrongly, they're trying to do the right thing, they err towards the side of communicating a little early. I would not make family your first three calls are like neurosurgery, the intensivist, and the family, because you don't know what to tell them yet. And it's just like needless worry. Talk to people when you have something useful to tell them, which is either that you've figured out what's going on and you have a plan or options for them. Or you know what it means, meaning, oh, like this person's brain dead, or it got better, or whatever. Or, you know, neurosurgeon wants to take them to the operating room, they're going to give you a call, something like that. Or when you've just reached a point where it looks like there may not be an end point here. And that's the message, because that's the penultimate notification before the one that, you know, this patient has died or is dying or something like that. That's the call you make, so that the first call they don't get is such a big step. So that's the one to make, like the patient is coding and there's nothing they need to do about that, but you don't want your first call to be the patient has died and we declared them.
Right.
That kind of thing. But otherwise, like, oh, the ICP is high. I mean, don't tell them that. Tell them, you know, there are signs that this pressure in the head has increased. We did a lot of medical things to try to fix it. It didn't work. The next step, if we want to consider it, is the surgeons to take part of the skull off. And that would be the most, you know, likely thing to help. And they're going to talk to you about that. But that's where we're at right now. Something like that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a good point too, right? To give them a heads up that they may be hearing from the surgeon, so that when the surgeon calls and says, we have to take them to their operating room and do blah, 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 and I need your consent, it's not this gut kick where they can't respond right away and the surgeon's having to tell them all the background, right? Odds are you've probably talked to this family multiple times throughout the stay. They maybe have a rapport with you. So kind of giving them the heads up that you're going to be hearing from the surgeons kind of lays the groundwork for both of them.
Yeah. People, I think, want to hear when there is if you think about like navigating in your car, when there is a change, when you're going left, you're going to need to slow down. If you're going on the same path, then maybe not. But yeah, if you're telling them we're going to do something different, or they started to get worse this shift, they started to get better, something like that. And sometimes no change is important too, when you expected one. But those are the times. So, and that's what people get upset about. Like the first call they hear is, oh, we need surgery. We didn't even hear that they were doing any worse, you know?
Yeah, we thought everything was great, right? Yeah. When we left the hospital, she was resting peacefully and everything was fine.
And that could be as simple as one call to be like, listen, he's been doing worse.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at right now. But
yeah.
All right. Anything else we should say about this?
No, certainly this is something that can run the gamut from a minor annoyance that, you know, you have to just do some troubleshooting, all the way up to it can be the beginning of a cascade that ends in, you know, really bad outcomes. So I think it's something that we need to take seriously and act on, but it's sometimes easy to get kind of lulled into that false sense of calm, because you're like, oh, again, right? The ICP, especially if you have something like you have a patient who's had issues with their EBD, or they're coughing all the time, or they're agitated all the time. You go, oh, yeah, again, I gotta get it. Their ICP's up, you know, and you can kind of lose track of the, well, this time might be the time that you gotta kind of spring into action.
Yeah, ICP is tough because it's sort of a like a vital sign in a lot of neurocritical care. And maybe like, you know, blood pressure or some other things, sometimes it is something to directly manipulate. Like it is a little high right now, we need to bring it down, something like that. Sometimes it is a marker for, you know, the overall milieu. And that's why the things that you're manipulating are sort of bigger picture. Like this patient is, you know, too agitated, they need to calm down, something like that. Or they're just sicker, they have more bleeding, more swelling, that's what we need to manage. And so in a sense, it can be a sort of prognostic tool. But this is neurocritical care in general. It's, you know, optimizing all the things you can optimize to give the best environment for a brain to recover or not get any worse. Whether it does is sort of up to it. So yeah. this mix between like, you know, fatalism or nihilism and, you know, doing all the things you can, which do make a difference, but you can't make a brain get better and you can't make an ICP go down to some extent, but it will sort of do what it wants.
Yeah. I often say neurocritical care can be summed up in three boxes. Box one is the initial management, you know, and that's usually not us. That's the pre-hospital folks or the ED folks or whatever. Box three is everything you would do in a normal ICU, right? Infection, therapeutic anticoagulation, blood clots, DVTs, and all those things. And box two is the prevention of secondary brain injury, right? And we talk about this a lot in TBI, but I think it applies in every case in the neuro ICU, whether it's status epilepticus, acute ischemic stroke, subarachnoid hemorrhage, whatever. Like you said, the initial damage is done, and there's nothing we can do about it to a certain extent. Where we earn our money is making sure that things don't get worse. And like you said, giving the brain space to heal. And it is a little bit fatalistic, I guess, to say, but you're right. Like sometimes the brain's just going to get better or it's not. And there's not a lot we can do. We can just try to help it.
Yeah, and anyone who thinks that this is a downside of neurocritical care, that's how most of the body works. You don't make anything get better. You just put a finger on the scale if you can, and then, you know, time will tell you how you did.
That's true. Maybe we're just more honest about it in the neuro ICU.
Well, I think the brain seems like more of a kind of black box, like it's more mysterious, whereas you look at the heart or something as a pump, and then it's more, well, we put more fluid in it or suck more fluid out or something like that. But the brain is like, the magic box isn't making the right smoke, you know, like do more rituals to it.
Yeah. I heard a surgeon say one time, God heals the patient, the doctor takes the fee. and yeah, I mean, I think you're right. To a certain degree, that's how it goes.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I'll tell families, like, a lot of what is going to happen is going to look like just waiting.
Yeah.
Because that's what's happening. We're waiting to see how things go. We don't know. You don't know. We're doing, you know, all the stuff we can in the meantime, but that's only so much.
Right.
You know, time will tell here. And that it's more time than you might think, especially for neuro stuff. Why don't we call it quits there? A nice kind of review of this topic. As you guys know, we're just sharing our own perspectives on this. Your own institution will have its own practices, and I hope you get some good training. ENLS is a good course if you're considering doing more neurocritical care, a good kind of foundation in general. And then over time, you'll develop your own processes and practices. But we will talk to you next time.